And hello, SunSounds listeners. This is Andy Bobmick, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about 6 weeks, titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Jeffrey Loves Blue. And then it's School of Fish, Mr. Wolf Goes to the Ball, The Real Cowgirl, The Enchanted Symphony, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Gently Bentley. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Jeffrey Loves Blue. Jeffrey likes blue. I love blue. There's no other color that Jeffrey likes more. Right, Jeffrey? That's right. Blue is the best. When Jeffrey gets up in the morning, he pulls on his blue socks first. My favorite socks have sailboats on them. Mom always wants to wash them. When his sailboat socks aren't in the wash, they are on his feet. Next, Jeffrey puts on his underwear, blue underwear. Then he puts on a blue shirt. But there's a white bird on it. Remember, Jeffrey, a bit of white is okay if it's with blue. Right, just a bit. It is sunny out. Jeffrey puts on a hat. Uncle Jim gave me a fishing hat. I wear it when the sun is out. It is light blue. There are many shades of blue, aren't there, Jeffrey? Sometimes blue is dark, like the ocean. Blue can be as different as night and day. Blue is the perfect color for me. Blue is a wonderful color, Jeffrey. Blueberries are my favorite. But sometimes you might have to try a different color, right? My art teacher says that. When Jeffrey goes to his Saturday painting class, he paints only in blue. I used it all up last time. You did. And Kiko wanted to use the blue, remember? She was sad. Jeffrey doesn't like when people are sad. It makes my tummy hurt. What did you do when Kiko looked sad? I told her she could use the blue next time. That was a kind thing to do. Did it make Kiko feel happy? She said, thank you. Today, Jeffrey is going back to painting class, and Kiko might want to use the blue. My teacher wants me to pick another color. Can you do that, Jeffrey? Blue is my color. Can you try to do that? Jeffrey knows he will have to do something he doesn't want to do. He will have to paint with a different color. Can you think of other colors you like, Jeffrey? Blue is the best. It is like a whale. You will always love blue, right? You also love painting. Painting is the best. If there wasn't any blue left in the entire world, would you stop painting? But the sky is blue. Is the sky always blue? Jeffrey, would you feel sad if you could never paint again? I couldn't wear my painting smock. Do you love painting enough to use green? Well, green isn't my favorite color. Yellow? Yellow is too bright. When you were little, you liked fire trucks. Red fire trucks, bright red. I like my red fire truck. It goes fast. Jeffrey, I can see you're thinking hard because you're pulling at your ear. Do you think you might like to paint in red? Red is a hot color, like a sunset. Let's think about red until we get to class. If you keep pulling your ears, it will turn red. When Jeffrey gets to class, the kids are already painting. So Jeffrey Will you paint with red today? Just for today. That's very brave of you. Red is a brave color. Jeffrey paints a red chicken in a red wagon inside a red barn with a red truck. Now I will need some new socks. Red ones. School of fish. Shiny, jelly-like balls float down, down, down. Emmy's eyes follow the blobs until they rest gently on the gravel at the bottom of the fish tank. These are eyed eggs, explains Miss Harris. See the black spots through the thin layer of the eggs? Those are eyes. We're going to hatch salmon to release into the wild. If you watch carefully the next few days, you might see movement inside the eggs, Miss Harris tells the class. Emmy winces. She's not sure she wants to see anything move, but she does watch, and watches some more. She has never helped care for any kind of animal before. Miss Harris says salmon prefer very cold water. We need a volunteer to check the water temperature every morning. Emmy raises her hand, and Miss Harris shows her how to read the water temperature. Salmon prefer to live in water that's 55 to 64 degrees Fahrenheit. Each morning, Emmy gets to school 15 minutes early. She takes the water temperature and gazes at the eggs. 1 week passes. Nothing yet. In science, the class learns about the six stages of a salmon's life. Egg, alvin, fry, par, smolt, and adult. In art class, brushes splash watercolors onto fish cutouts. In gym, the class plays tag. Predators chase salmon. Only the fastest, smartest salmon survive. And then, one morning, when she is looking at the eggs, Emmy sees it. It's happening, she shouts. Desk empty as everyone angles for a good look. A few eggs wiggle, others jiggle. Bam! The first little head breaks through an orange egg membrane, then another and another. What cute babies, says a boy. What cute alvin, corrects Emmy. Each day, the students look into the tank. The alvin have orange pouches called egg sacs attached to their bellies. The tiny fish get food from their sacs. As the alvin get bigger, the sacs get smaller. One morning, Emmy notices that the egg sacs have disappeared. It's Friday. It's Friday, she tells her classmates. No, it's Thursday, says her friend Evie. Emmy knows our alvin have become fry, explains Miss Harris. Caring for fry takes teamwork. Some students feed the growing fish. Others test the quality of the water, making sure the fish are getting the correct amount of food. In the writing nook, students make lists of words to describe the fry. Twitchy, silvery, slippery, scaly. During library, they read books about the importance of salmon to indigenous peoples. Some of these tribes celebrate the salmon with artwork and ceremonies. During math, students figure out how far a salmon might swim during its lifetime. They learn salmon can swim up to 34 miles a day. Over the 2 to 7 years it lives, a salmon might travel 7,000 miles or more. Emmy gasps. She gets tired paddling across the pool. Salmon release day nears. We'll load the fry into a cooler and take them to the stream, says Miss Harris. We'll look for the best release spot. She explains that boulders, logs, and shade help fry hide from predators, such as birds and larger fish. Side channels in the stream and pools give the fry places to rest if waters rush too quickly. Emmy is determined to help find the perfect spot for these tiny salmon. On release day, the class divides into groups. Parents and other teachers help each group. Some students stand in a field to practice, casting fishing lines and reeling them back in. Some groups use magnifying glasses to examine water samples from the stream. They spy sand, feathery plants, and bugs with long legs. Still, others learn how non-native plants can harm wetlands. The fun has almost made Emmy forget about what she and her classmates came here to do. Almost. They gather at the stream where Miss Harris gives them all paper cups filled with water. One fry is swimming inside each cup. Name your fish, Miss Harris encourages them. There's a Jim, a Ralph, and a Scout. Some get silly names. Cheddar, Bubbles, Belly Button. Emmy names her fry Skipper. Wish your fry a safe trip, says Miss Harris. She stands by the water's edge. One by one, the students walk to the stream, kneel down, and gently tilt the cups, releasing their fry into the wild. Emmy whispers into her cup, I believe in you, Skipper. Emmy wonders how many of their fry will make it to adulthood. How many will survive the long trip from this small stream all the way to the river and the ocean, then back to the stream to spawn? She worries about dangers, travel past dams and waterfalls. She knows many of the fish will be eaten by bears or eagles, even caught by people fishing along the way. Emmy is proud she is part of a school of students that raised a school of fish. Mr. Wolf goes to the ball. One day, an invitation arrived for Mr. Wolf. Dear Mr. Wolf, you are cordially invited to attend the animal ball. Attire, formal, and fabulous. Regrets only. Mr. Wolf was very excited. He rushed to his wardrobe and found a hat? No. It was a very long scarf? No. Many pairs of beautiful socks? No, they weren't quite right. Nothing was quite right. Just then, sheep arrived at the door for their morning walk. Mr. Wolf was so excited about his invitation, but I don't know what to wear. As they strolled along, chatting about outfits, Mr. Wolf spotted something in a shop window. Look, that would be perfect for the ball. Sheep thought so too, but... Oh, dear, said Mr. Wolf. I think that might be too expensive. I bet together we can make you a dress that's just as beautiful, said Sheep. Mr. Wolf was delighted, and they headed home immediately to get started. There were a few hiccups, but after a lot of hard work, Mr. Wolf's new dress was finished. And just in time for the ball. Wow, said Sheep, you look amazing. Mr. Wolf thought so too. He proudly showed his new dress to his friends. You know, said the bird, you are a mister, and misters don't wear dresses. Definitely not, said the turtle. Well, said the cat, I don't think that's the right thing at all. Mr. Wolf looked in the mirror sadly. He felt ridiculous. He took off his new dress. Sheep arrived to walk Mr. Wolf to the ball. "Hey, where's your party outfit?" Mr. Wolf looked so sad. "I think, actually, that dresses are only for girls." "Nonsense," said Sheep. "Remember, you can wear anything that makes you feel amazing." And Mr. Wolf remembered. He remembered how good his ball dress made him feel. And he'd made it with his friend, Sheep. That made him feel even better. "Just give me a minute. I'll be right back." "Great," said Sheep. "We're going to the ball." On their way to the ball, Mr. Wolf felt a bit shy. He still wasn't sure if his dress was right. But when he opened the door to the ballroom, he knew his dress was perfect. Mr. Wolf danced all night and had a wonderful time. He was so glad he had worn his beautiful new dress. The Real Cowgirl. Sal wants to be a real cowgirl with boots and a hat just like Dad's. She is brave and smart and strong and wild. All the things a cowgirl should be. We ride through the paddocks. We gallop up the biggest hills, and it feels like we are flying. But Sal doesn't feel like a cowgirl at school. She doesn't feel brave or smart or strong or wild. She feels small and scared instead. I wish I could go to school with her and we could show all the other kids our circus tricks. Then they would see that Sal is a fierce, kind, wonderful friend, just like a real cowgirl should be. After school, we ride behind the cows, and even though she's sad, Sal smiles at the birds among the leaves. When the cows go the wrong way, we race them through the trees together, leaping over logs. We are flying in the wind. One day, Sal says she was brave at school. She says she told her class about our rides, about how fast we are, about all our circus tricks. She says she made a new friend. On the weekend, we ride together over the hills and down the road between our houses. We explore the paddocks and find fairy houses underneath the trees. We are on a secret mission to save the world. In the morning, Sal skips on her way to school. She says that she feels brave today. Sal says she wants to be a real cowgirl. But I think she already is. The Enchanted Symphony. And this is co-written with Julie Andrews. Piccolino lived in a small village, famous for its charms. Its people were happy and creative. Singing and dancing felt as natural to them as breathing. They cherished their families, their friendships, and the abundant green countryside around them. And they delighted in their exquisite opera house, where Piccolino's father was the maestro of the orchestra. Visitors came from miles around to enjoy the village's delights. To keep the sightseers happy, the townspeople built more shops to sell trinkets, gadgets, and souvenirs. They baked scrumptious cookies and cakes and planted bigger and more colorful window boxes. But the busier and more prosperous they became, the more they lost touch with their own simple pleasures. One day, Piccolino noticed a faint purple mist creeping into the village. At first, everyone was too busy to be concerned, but soon it thickened and spread from home to home, garden to garden. It crept into cottages and shops, sweeping through windows and under doors, until eventually the entire village was blanketed in fog. Trees and flowers began to wilt. Birds no longer sang, and the sun, moon, and stars disappeared from view. People grew listless and dispirited. They stopped visiting with one another or even going outside, and the town fell silent. The opera house sat empty, but for Piccolino and his father, who summoned the energy each week to clean the pretty auditorium, lest the fog damage the velvet seats and curtains. They dusted the gold-trimmed balconies and crystal chandeliers, and they watered the drooping plants in the lobby, though it didn't seem to help. One day, as the maestro was sweeping the stage, Piccolino wandered over to the grand piano. Gently raising the lid, he played a simple melody that echoed in the empty space. The sound was startling and sweet, and the maestro paused to listen. For a moment, his spirits lifted, and he realized how much he had missed music. But without an audience, the orchestra had no reason to play. As a boy and his father prepared to close up for the day, Piccolino noticed something surprising. The palms in the lobby seemed to be standing taller. On a hunch, he ran back to the piano and played his little tune again. Sure enough, the palms looked fresher still. Piccolino called to his father to come see what had happened. The maestro scratched his chin for a moment. Then, at Piccolino's urging, he agreed to try an experiment. Returning home, they loaded their ailing houseplants onto a wagon and wheeled them to the opera house. Once again, when Piccolino played the piano, the plants seemed to brighten. This called for an even bigger experiment. With growing excitement, father and son pushed through the fog, knocking on doors and begging friends and neighbors to donate their sickly plants to an important cause. In time, the opera house was so filled with foliage that it began to look more like a garden than a theater. Now the maestro joined his son at the piano. Together, they played a lively air. But with so many poorly plants, one piano duet didn't seem enough to help them all. Piccolino and his father suddenly knew what to do. They placed chairs and music stands on the stage. They laid out pages of sheet music and lit the chandeliers. Then they braved the fog one last time to visit every member of the orchestra. They implored the musicians to rise above their melancholy and summon the strength to come immediately to the opera house. There was an audience that urgently needed their music. One by one, the bewildered musicians made their way to the stage. They slowly took their seats and began to tune their instruments. The maestro raised his baton, and there was a momentary hush. Piccolino pulled on a heavy rope that stretched to the ceiling. The great velvet curtains swung open. Plants of all shapes and sizes filled the hall to capacity, all the way to the uppermost tier. Every seat, every box, every balcony spilled over with greenery. The astonished musicians began to play, tentatively at first, but gradually building in strength and tempo as the joy of making music again lifted their spirits. And the plants responded in kind, nodding and swaying their stems, standing taller and firmer, their leaves rustling in appreciation. And then the fog itself began to lift. Piccolino ran to the opera house doors and flung them wide. Music poured into the streets, and rainbows of color returned to the cottages and gardens. Birds chirped sleepily, then began to sing. Curious villagers opened their doors and windows, then ventured outside, calling to friends and neighbors. Before long, a throng of people were winding their way through the village, enchanted by the glorious sounds, emancipating from the opera house. But there wasn't a seat to be had, so they stood shoulder to shoulder, crowding the square, their hearts so full of joy that they couldn't help but nod and sway, then dance and sing. Eventually, the mysterious fog vanished altogether, leaving the village bathed in radiant light. And the boy, the maestro, and the townspeople understood that if they remained faithful to all that matters most, nothing could darken their days again. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a story about a rhinoceros that is titled Gently Bentley. This is a picture of Bentley Oliver Anthony Brown, and he's a baby rhinoceros. He is 5.5 years old. He is a bright little spark, very tough and very bold. Bentley is full of energy and gets excited easily. And sometimes this can get him into trouble. Gently, Bentley. There was the time Bentley had eggs for breakfast. He was in such a rush that the yolk went everywhere. Gently, Bentley. When it was time to go to school, Bentley ran down the stairs with such thunderous haste that the ceiling cracked. Gently, Bentley. It was the same story at school. Bentley was in such a rush to fetch his pencils and books that it was difficult for him to hold on to them all. Everything just went flying. Gently, Bentley. During break, he loved to play chase. But his friends weren't so sure. Hey, gently, Bentley. On the way home, Bentley wanted to see the ducks. But the ducks had other ideas. They all ran away. Later that night, Bentley spotted the baby sleeping in the cot. Baby was very quiet. And this time, Bentley was very, very gentle. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been reading now for about 6 weeks, titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. Jack Henry, the hero of Heads or Tails, Stories from the Sixth Grade, is back. It is the summer after sixth grade, and Jack and his offbeat family have relocated to the island of Barbados. Jack hopes he's escaping the craziness of his old life in Florida. But even in a Caribbean paradise, he is plagued by misadventure. He gets a violent case of blood poisoning and ends up painted purple from head to toe, discovers the perils of male bonding in a pepper-eating contest with his father, and has his heartstrings twanged by an older woman, his sister's best friend, to name just a few of his troubles. But in this 8 fierce and funny stories, Jack always perseveres, sometimes with the help of one of the few reliable things in his life, his trusty diary. And today I'm going to begin the fourth story, which is titled New Power. It was the middle of summer, and the flies were driving us nuts. There were millions of them. We were overrun. Our house didn't have window screens, so they buzzed us all day and all night. But I had a plan. I knew that if you want to wipe out snakes, you introduce the mongoose, its natural enemy. And before long, the snakes are eaten and gone. If you want to get rid of mice, you buy a cat. And I knew that to get rid of flies, you bring in lizards. So I did. I went out to the backyard and trapped a dozen and set them loose in my room. At first, it was great. They zapped the flies with their long, sticky tongues and swallowed them whole. But soon, they ate so many, they got fat and full and lay around the room with their eyes closed and arms and legs spread open like burned-out tourists. I stomped around the floor with a ruler, shouting, "Wake up! Time to sing for your supper. Eat, eat." I slapped the ruler against the wall and startled them into moving their lizard lard. But they were useless and only lurched forward a few inches before taking another siesta. "Forget that idea," I said out loud. "This is a man's job." I got the fly swatter and went to work. Whack! One down. Whack! Another. Killing them properly is all in the wrist. If I swatted them with too much force, I splattered fly juice all over the wall and had to scrub them off with a rag dipped in bleach. It worked better to snap my wrist very crisply, like hitting the triangle in music class. Whack! 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 I became bloodthirsty. One at a time wasn't good enough. I lined up two at a time, three at a time. I swatted them out of midair. Eventually, I became so fast, I grabbed them with my bare hand and held them underwater in the sink until they drowned. By the time my frenzy was over, I counted 173 dead. But it didn't make a dent in the fly population. 173 flies immediately buzzed through my window and took their place. I tried to rally my lizard workers to eat more, but they were stuffed, and when I smacked the ruler around their tails, they wouldn't even tremble. I accidentally hit one and cut its tail off. I picked it up and pressed the broken part against the tip of my nose. The lizard blood was thick and gummy. The tail wiggled around like a tiny bullwhip. "Mush, mush," I shouted, and lowered my nose, so the little whip lashed their backs. They didn't even twitch. They stuck to the wall like refrigerator magnets. I collected my flies and pressed them into my diary. Crunch. It was like making a fly sandwich. Then I took a pen and wrote 173 on the plastic fly swatter flap. I plan to kill 1 million, save them for proof, and get into the Guinness Book of World Records. But after a while, the flies were no challenge. I had to move up. I had to find something more difficult to exterminate. I was getting older, and killing flies was a kid's game. I went out to the backyard. We had an abandoned well filled with bats. The well opening was cemented over except for a hole the size of a brick. Every evening, a ribbon of bats flew out of the hole to eat insects. They spread out and darted overhead, cutting the air up into little jigsaw pieces. Now they were difficult to hit. That was a challenge. The only problem was that Dad had told me not to mess with them. "They are animals," he said. "You never throw rocks at animals." He told me this after he caught me whipping broken shards of bathroom tile at them. he said. He was worried about me hurting the bats. But I knew it was really that he was worried about where the pieces of tile and rocks would land. There were a lot of houses around, and he was touchy about breaking windows. Johnny Name told me that it was impossible to hit a bat with a rock. They have built-in radar, he explained. You can't throw rocks at them all day and never hit them. You can't even shoot a bat. They move faster than bullets. Cool, I thought. They were just the challenge I was after. I got a yardstick and poked it down into the hole and stirred it around. I didn't hear anything. I put my eye to the hole and looked in. I was a bit afraid one of them would come shooting out and bite me on the eyeball. But I knew that was impossible. Dad said they ate only bugs and vegetables. Just then, Bobo 2 brushed against the back of my leg. I jumped up into the air. God, you scared me! Remember, Bobo 2 is their dog. Betsy had got him as a birthday gift. She named him after her other black spaniel, Bobo 1. That was a mistake. Bobo 1 was a loser, and this one was even worse. He rolled over and fell asleep. Something was wrong with that dog. It needed vitamins, and it smelled. Suddenly, a bat flew up out of the hole and fluttered back and forth overhead. I picked up a bunch of rocks and fired at it. I didn't even get close. Then a stream of them came out in a steady black line. They zipped back and forth above the house, eating millions of flies. Eat more, I shouted. Get fat. Slow down and I'll nail you. I threw about 100 rocks. Everything missed. They were about 1 million times harder to hit than flies. As quickly as they had all come out of the hole, they returned into it, like the smoke sucking back into Aladdin's lamp. I waited a few minutes for them to settle down, then picked up a brick. If their radar is so good, I said to Bobo 2, then they can dodge rocks in their sleep. I dropped the brick down into the hole. Nothing happened. I chucked a few more pieces of brick into the hole. A single bat came out of the well and dove at my head. It startled me, and I yelled and tripped backward over Bobo 2. My feet went up over my head, and the bat zoomed in on my sneaker and bit it on the rubber tip. I didn't know what bat teeth looked like, but they went through my tennis shoe and missed my toe. If it's a vampire bat, I thought, I'm a quarter inch from being turned into a vampire and living with Dracula for the rest of time. I had seen the movie. I pumped my foot up and down, but I couldn't shake it off. I threw a rock up at it, but missed and hit my ankle. I picked up another rock and whipped it at the bat. I missed, but I heard the sound of breaking glass. Oh, crap, I thought. What had I hit? But I still had the bat to deal with. I used the toe of my good shoe to wedge the heel off my bat shoe. It fell to the ground, but the bat hung on. I jumped up and hobbled off to find what I broke. It couldn't have been worse. It was Dad's office window. Ay, Chihuahua, I moaned. Now I've done it. This was the second time I'd broken Dad's office window. The first time, I hit it with a tennis ball. I was playing by myself against the garage door when I smacked the ball right through the pane. It was an accident. Dad gave me a warning, which basically went, if it happens again, I'm going to use my belt. He meant business. I wanted to run, but knew hiding would just make it worse. As Dad would say, take your punishment like a man. He was right. I couldn't act like a boy forever. I was already 13. I squatted down and picked up all the glass shards. When I was little, I always called broken glass ghost teeth. That seemed like 1,000 years ago. This was just broken glass, plain and simple. After I cleaned up, I wrote a note and taped it on his office door. I didn't tell him about the bat. One thing at a time, I cautioned myself. Then I returned to my room to wait. Maybe he would just come in and tell me one of his lesson stories. I flipped through the section of my diary where I wrote them down. There wasn't one for my particular problem. Once upon a time, I wrote, there was a son who didn't listen to his father. He repeatedly screwed up, but the father was patient, and eventually the son figured out how not to get into trouble every day of the week. Eventually, he thanked his father for his patience. But that evening, when he opened my bedroom door, his belt was already off. I didn't even get a chance to explain my side of the story. "You know the rules," he said. "It was an accident," I replied, lowering my eyes. "There is no such thing as an accident," he said, quoting himself. "There is right and there is wrong. There is thoughtful thinking and thoughtless thinking. Your thinking today was thoughtless, and what you did was wrong. That is not an accident." I felt trapped by his thinking. "It was an accident," I said weakly. "Don't you get it? Children have accidents. Men make choices. Just do as you're told," he replied impatiently. I put my hands out and leaned against the wall. He reached into my back pocket, removed my wallet, and flicked it onto the bed. Then he reared back and gave me 5 cracks in a row. When he finished, he slid the belt through the loops of his pants. It looked like a snake curling around his waist. "You'll never grow up properly if you don't listen to me," he said, and left the room. I pulled down my pants and sat on the cool floor. I decided I'd never let this happen again. I'd never break his window, and I'd never let him hit me. I was tired of being on the bottom of the heap. I wanted some power of my own. I was sick of beating up flies, lizards, and bats. Those were kids' games. And the longer I played like a kid, the more I was treated like one, and the less power I had. That night, when Mom and Dad came home from the Beau Brummel Club, they started arguing. I listened at my bedroom door. From the volume of their voices, I could tell they were in the living room. They were arguing about the same stuff they always fought over. Mom wanted to return to Pennsylvania. She didn't like being so far away from her family. "Nonsense," Dad replied. "If we lived back there, I'd be out in the snow framing houses for peanuts. That place is a dead end. We have no future there." "Well, what do we have here?" she asked. "A bunch of rummy friends and no family?" He poured a drink. "We have friends," he said. "And you are drinking too much," she added. "Don't start that again," he snapped, and sat down heavily on the couch. I picked up my diary and put a pen between 2 blank pages. "It's now or never," I said to myself. "I've got to fight back. If he wants me to listen to his every word, I've got to be close enough to hear them all." I took a deep breath, opened the door, and went down the hall. I stood by the dining room table and stared at them. Dad was spread across the couch with his head propped up on the arm. Mom was standing, her black evening shoes dangling in her hand by their heel straps. She had a tissue in the other hand and was wiping off her red lipstick. I caught her speaking in mid-sentence. "And I called Mother," she said, "and told her I wanted to come home for a few weeks." "Do what you want," Dad said, and waved at a fly. "I can get along just fine without you complaining all day and night." Then he saw me. He hopped up onto his feet and put his drink down as though he hadn't said or done anything nasty. Just like an adult, I thought, always trying to act innocent. They use one set of rules around us and another for themselves. "What are you doing up?" he demanded. Mom propped her hand on her hip. "Writing," I replied, trying to keep my voice steady. "Writing what?" "In my diary," I said. "He means, what are you writing?" Mom said, stepping between us. Then I unleashed the line I had been waiting to use. The one that I hoped would turn the tide and put me in control. "I'm writing down all the things you say," I replied. I looked down at my diary and began to write his last question. "Stop it," he ordered. I wrote down, "Stop it," in my diary. "I think you should return to your room and read," Mom suggested, crossing her arms. I slowly wrote down what she'd said. "Let me see what you've written," he commanded. He was angry. He picked up his drink and finished it. When he lowered his glass, his eyes were red and narrow. My grandmother had once said to me, "Alcohol can turn the gentlest lamb into a lion." I believed her. "Give me that," he held out his hand. "No," I said. "When Mom gave me the diary, she said it was mine." He groaned and rolled his eyes. "Your mother told you that?" "Yes." Mom took a deep breath and let it all out slowly. "Anyway," she said to Dad, "I don't want to talk about it tonight." Dad took a step toward me. I bit my lip. "Here he comes," I thought. "Don't look away. No matter what he does, don't look away. He's going to grab my diary and toss it across the room and take out his belt." But he didn't. He ran his hands through his hair, turned, and left the room. "If I were you," Mom said, once he was safely down the hall, "I wouldn't try this stunt too many times." "Why not?" I thought to myself. "It worked. I'll do it 100 times in a row if I want to." "And another thing," she said, "I don't like your attitude." "Great," I thought. I could feel the new power in me, the power to annoy her. "I think you need to go to your room," she said. "Fine with me," I replied. "It will give me more time to write all this down in my diary." She groaned. I could tell she regretted getting me a diary, but it was too late to take it back. I stood up and retreated down the hall. I was feeling very powerful as I closed and locked my bedroom door. I opened my French doors and stepped out. I climbed up into the avocado tree and looked up and down the street. I was taller than any of the houses. I was taller than Dad. "The pin is mightier than the sword," I whispered. I finally understood what that meant. A few days later, Mom opened my bedroom door and sat on the edge of my bed. She had just returned from having her hair and nails done. "I have something to tell you," she said seriously. "Sit down." I sat next to her and sniffed the air. She smelled like hairspray and nail polish remover and lots of gardenia perfume. I took a deep breath and held it in. "I spoke with Grandma, and we have decided to go up and visit her for a month. I'm taking Pete and Eric, but you and Betsy have to stay here." "Why?" I blurted. "I'm always left behind." I felt betrayed. "Because your father and I had a talk and agreed that if we stay in Barbados longer than the summer, maybe for a long time, you will have to get ready for school here." "But it's July," I said. "July." She paused. "You have to go to summer school," she said. "The school system here is more advanced than in Florida. If you don't go to summer school to catch up, you'll have to repeat sixth grade. No way, I groaned. Florida is screwing me up again. I had told her my last school was for simpletons only, but she didn't believe me. Now she knows, and I have to suffer the consequences, as usual. Which means, Mom continued, that you have to stay here with Betsy and Dad for a month. I know this is not fun, but Marlene will cook and keep your clothes clean, and you are old enough to be responsible. I'm old enough when you want me to be responsible. So you can do what you want, but I'm always too young when it comes to doing what I want. Well, you're not a kid anymore, she said. You are a young man. Act like one. She stood up. I don't want to hear any back talk, she said in her bossy voice. You understand that this is the best situation we can work out for everyone. This whole family doesn't revolve around you and your needs. She frowned, which meant she had spoken the truth according to Mom. And that was that. She left the room. You've just thrown me to the wolves, I shouted. The wolves! She opened the door and smiled at me. She was so beautiful, I forgot to be mad. Your sister said the same thing, she said and laughed. She glided toward me and gave me a big hug. You know, she said, I think this will give you and your dad some time together to smooth out some of your friction. What do you mean? I asked. I was pretty sure our relationship was about winning and losing, about who was the boss and who was the peon. You know what I mean, she said. You're getting older, and you are starting to bump heads with your dad. I wasn't ready to discuss it, so I changed the subject. I'll miss you, I said. I'll miss you more than you'll miss me, she replied, and became teary-eyed, which made me feel like a jerk for ever saying anything mean to her, even though she was leaving me with Dad and Betsy for a month. She was my mom. It was my job to be nice to her no matter what. 2 days later, they were gone, and Betsy and I were eating dinner with Dad. Marlene served a platter of flying fish and okra. I love this fish, I said to Marlene. Thank you, she said in her formal voice. When she passed me, she bent forward and whispered, We'll have chicken hearts this week. Yum! Tomorrow, Dad started, delivering the opening word to our evening announcements. The driver will pick you up and take you to the prep school. Marlene will have your lunches packed. After school, you'll come directly home and do your studies. Marlene will have dinner for you every night at 6. If I'm not home, eat without me and be in bed by 9. Any questions? Betsy didn't argue with him. I didn't either. I pulled my plate close to my chest, lowered my mouth, and scraped the food in. Look at him, Betsy said arrogantly. He uses Bobo 2's rules of eating. First, eat everything as quickly as possible. Second, eat everything you dropped on the table or floor. Third, wash it down by slurping loudly. Fourth, nose around for more. Fifth, when there is no more, lick your lips and drift away. I stared at Dad. If Mom were here, she would ask Betsy to apologize. Dad laughed. You know, he said to Betsy, as if I weren't present, the best way to feed Jack would be to put a funnel in his mouth and just pour it down his throat. Now it was her turn to laugh. Without Mom, I was a ping-pong ball, whacked back and forth. May I be excused, I asked, and was halfway out my chair. Only if you'll get our fishing gear organized, Dad said. I thought you'd like to join me. All right, I love to fish. I ran into the kitchen and called Shiva. We were supposed to go running later on. I'm tired anyway, he said, after I canceled. I'm sluggish. I have a cure for that. Whenever I'm sluggish, Mom always gives me prunes and warm water. I guarantee that in no time you'll be on the run. Really? Yeah, cross my heart, I said. You'll be running like a fiend. Okay, he replied. I'll try it. I put down the phone and headed for the garage. I got our rods, tackle boxes, net, and gaff hook, then loaded it all into the truck. I knew the routine. When Dad arrived, we drove to the St. Lawrence Gap, a stony jetty starting from the back of the St. Lawrence Hotel. It curved out into the ocean like a 100-foot-long question mark. We carried our gear to the tip and got set up. The ocean was calm. The swells slowly brushed along the rocks and sighed as they broke across the sand. The first one to catch a fish gets to send the other guy to the bar to get drinks, Dad said. Okay. It was a fair deal. That's what I liked about fishing. It put us on equal ground. You cast out your line, and the fish don't know the difference between a man and a boy. Dad reared back and cast his chrome triple-hooked spinner. The line spun off the reel. Plop. It landed about 50 yards away. He let it sink down and slowly reeled it in with his thumb pressed against the spool of line to feel for bites. He was going for big bottom feeders like grouper and trigger fish. I took a different approach. I opened my tackle box and attached a bobber to my line, then got my secret weapon, a dragonfly. I put it on the hook and gently cast it out, so it floated about 70 feet from the rocks. I was after surface feeders, especially red snapper, which was my favorite. Together, we stood there with our rods pressed against our bellies like two guys peeing off a dock. And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating, funny novel titled Jack's New Power, Stories from a Caribbean Year. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.